Mickey is here, and her session is about the course Responding to the Call of Our Times, a leadership coaching course that she offers. And this will be her fourth year in 2020.
I know that we're about to start the fourth year, and it still was shocking to hear it, to recognize that this is actually speaking to a very particular hunger that I see people having. I designed this course before Donald Trump was elected, and it started right after he was elected. And I didn't know that he was going to be elected. It was already before he was elected, things were incredibly challenging in the world. And I know I'm talking to a whole lot of people who don't live in the United States. And there is this peculiar way of where I know there's a lot of resentment in many places in the world about how much space the United States takes in terms of conversations and news and stuff like that. And unfortunately, I understand why that is, because the decisions of one man and the group of people that surround him have an influence that is global. And if we really want to create change at this point in time, I don't think we can create change without thinking global. Wherever we take action, however we take it, if we don't have a global context of a global crisis that is affecting all of us, though it is affecting people differently, depending on where we are, both geographically and on what I call the power map of the world, without a global context, we are less effective. So since the course started, things have only gotten more acute. I have a sense of there's like a volume that keeps being turned up and up and up and up in terms of how much tension and suffering and loss of hope are spreading around the world. And while the response, what is an adequate response, keeps changing, the requirement to respond keeps increasing. It is less and less possible for more and more people to just live a personal, individual life as if everything is normal. You know, this past year in California, for example, and I was out of California for most of the time of this, people are beginning to experience what it's like to live without electricity when you're used to living with electricity. So the normal, the shielding that people in the U.S., that most people in the U.S. have experienced, is being removed gradually, even here. So my sense is that the hunger is growing, that people really want to know what to do. Because in the absence of knowing what to do, what your options are to be numb, to kind of like buckle down and just live your life, to fight against things with a kind of angry, disempowered way, or, you know, another short list of other things, take alcohol and drugs, whatever. And none of this is an adequate response, and we all know it. So I'm just noticing that there is growing hunger, because year three had more people than year two registered for it. And you would think, well, it's the same course. Why would there be more people if people like, okay, check, I already took it. It's not a course like this. It is completely evolutionary in terms of it is constantly evolving. Week by week, it changes what happens based on what people bring and also my own evolving thinking. This course is my laboratory for where I test out things, where I explore things with people, and where we co-create new understandings. So that's all I want to say by way of introducing it. I want to now open it to people who are moved by what I just shared, or by anything else you know from my writings, or you've been in the course already, and you have a place where you want to increase your capacity to step into leadership in a way that is effective, caring, and integrity, bold, and you could use some support. This is now your time. Anyone is welcome.
The question that I have, or something that I would love support in, is I actually moved from being a leader in various activist groups more and more into NVC and stepping back more, because it's more and more painful to be there for me, to really take in what's happening in the world. Even now I get very emotional about it, because it's so overwhelming. And like you said, sometimes I read the newspaper and I can only take it if I really numb myself. Otherwise, I start crying with the first sentences.
Okay, so let me just first start by asking you a question. What's wrong with crying?
Nothing. It's just I wonder about where to find my place in this, because I feel like I'm stepping back from being a leader in my level.
So I don't know you, right? I don't think we've ever spoken.
No.
So I can only speak in generalities because I don't know you. If we get into anything specific, then I will get to know you personally. What you are sharing with me is very common for me to hear and think about. Why do people step back from leadership in activist organizations and in alternative groups, etc.? There are usually several reasons. One is what you are saying, or at least a piece of it that I'm hearing. That is that leaders tend to not do enough mourning. And it's something that our culture does not encourage. Mourning, crying, being with strong emotions. You know, I regularly think about the fact that in psychiatric institutions, when people cry, which is an act designed to heal the body and soul, that is nature provided us with this capacity that moves us towards healing. In psychiatric institutions, for the most part, when people cry, they're given drugs to stop the crying. The culture doesn't support it. Not because somebody is thinking consciously, oh, if she cries, she's going to be more effective. It's that the fear of effectiveness in going against the norm is so big that it's internalized in all of us that we shouldn't cry. And the reality that I see is that as progressively more challenging in the world, we will need to put more of our time into crying. There will be less time in the day that we will able to do the things that we commonly associate with leading, because we will need more time to mourn and integrate the acceleration of horrors. So that's one. Second, often enough, leaders don't have enough support. So I tell this to people, and I know that Dominic Barter tells this to people all the time: get more support, get systemic support, build support into the very, very fiber of how your group, organization, community, movement, whatever works. And people rarely, if ever, do it. So that's the second reason why people leave. The third reason is that they are attacked. We have a culture of attacking leaders in our movements. It's awful. It's deeply demoralizing. Even if you didn't experience it personally in relation to you, you've experienced it in relation to other leaders. It's an epidemic. And I would say even more, the more caring you are, the more capable of being with people in an empathic way, the more attacks you will receive, because you then make yourself safe, whereas the people whose actions are the motor force of the horrors that are happening in the world, even though they're not the source of it, their actions are the motor force. They don't make themselves available. So you will get the rage that has essentially nothing to do with you. And those mechanisms are not well explored or well examined. And certainly there's no systemic response within our movements to attend to them. So that's another reason. One other reason is that we have notions of leadership that are intertwined with notions of power in such a way that leaders believe that A, they have to make all the decisions, they have to do everything. And even if you don't believe it consciously, there's somewhere in your body that this belief persists, and it creates unsustainable overwhelm. So I want to pause and just hear from you a little bit about how all this finds you.
What really stuck with me is that we don't mourn. Like when I think back to the work I did, it was not enough mourning. It was no mourning at all. Like to hold each other empathically in what's around us and how painful it is. It really had no space at all. And that really makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, because when you don't mourn, all the energy that doesn't get mourned turns violent. It turns violent towards self or towards others or both. Turning violence towards self is numbness, self-judgment, drugs, alcohol.
Or just work more and more and more and more. It's never going to be enough. Like to have this belief, it's never enough. It's never enough.
Yes. All of these things go against the self. Or it turns into bitterness, judgment, accusations, mean-spiritedness, cynical joking, or outright violence against others. So mourning is nature's gift of tears to fill the gap between how we want things to be and how they are. So it sounds like that's the prescription for you. It ties directly to support because when you think about doing more mourning, do you have the people that you can do mourning with?
I started to create a place where I have this. And that's the other thing you said, like what I realized is that what changed in getting more support, showing up more vulnerable, listen empathically more, is that like the hierarchy I was in, like I was their boss, it became a real burden for me. Like I couldn't handle it anymore and it felt very unnatural and weird, and because there are all these expectations.
Changing the paradigm of leadership is one of the key things that we need to learn. There's a saying that comes out of an African-American woman, poet and essayist that has finally spread around the globe, I think. Audre Lorde is her name. And the saying is, the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. And we still keep trying to, in my language, to use patriarchal methods to transform patriarchy. It won't work. So if we recreate the structures that we received from patriarchy of leaders that are positional leaders and others who are followers and all that comes with that, we're going to end up with a different world in the end. It just will change who are the players and what is the ideology. We changed very little when we had a Bolshevik revolution in the name of really beautiful ideals that installed new people in power and changed almost nothing in the actual systems that governed the lives of millions of people in Russia. There is actual research that shows that there's more similarity between the Soviet Union's bureaucracy and the Russian Tsarist bureaucracy from before the revolution. Fascinating. So another thing that I want to check in with you again, because I don't know you. My guess is that you don't have the option of not leading if you were to understand leadership properly. That anywhere you go, step into leadership.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
So if that is true, then you may as well do it consciously, with choice, and differently. Because the way that I define leadership is an orientation to life. It's not a position you're in. The vast majority of people who are in so-called leadership positions, the leaders of the world, they're not leaders. They are people in power, but I don't see them as leading. For me, leadership has to come from care for the whole. If you don't care for the whole, you're not leading. You are making decisions, telling people what to do, making people do things, frightening people, even inspiring people, but you're not holding them, the whole of life, within your choices. That's what leadership is. And I imagine that you do that everywhere you go. Guilty as charged?
Yes, I hope so.
And, you know, there's a category that I call general manager of the universe. And, you know, one of the characteristics, at least I know it's for me, I will go into a store. I have nothing to do with the store. And I walk around and I see things that have been put out of place. I take them and put them back in their place. Why do I do that? Because there's some kind of like native inherent care that I didn't turn off. It's there. We all have it, but we turn it off. And I didn't. And my guess is that those people who cannot help but lead are the ones that don't turn off care. And considering how much the existing society has created conditions in which caring is a luxury, most of us have turned off care. And then those of us who do care have more work than we can handle. So I'm going to just leave you with this. Get support, do the morning, be conscious about where and how you lead, more so than whether.
Thank you.
I'm curious, this is also one of the things that I usually do in the course itself, is if there's anyone who has any follow-up comments or questions to this little exchange, so that conversation and not just one-on-one. If anyone has any, please raise your hand.
Yes. So I'm in the United States. And one, thank you for your honest introduction of life in the United States. I find I continue to step up to lead. And in my community, one of the requests from the NVC trainers was that the trainers ourselves needed a practice and support group. So we've started that. So I completely appreciate your comment to setting up a community, finding the people, and making it happen. And I appreciate your comment and take to heart and hear and am digesting the value of mourning coupled with the value and practice of integration. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and so those two things holding hands, you know, or linking hands with the next thing, is just creates a lot of ease inside my body. It's like, yay. So thank you.
You're reminding me that there was one more thing that I didn't that I was going to say to Tanya, and then it fell out of my mind in the moment. And that is the role of NVC within the work for social change. There is sadly a whole lot more people who are involved in social change movements, learn NVC and quit the movement. Then there are people who learn NVC and embrace the work of social change as a result. That there's something we're doing with NVC that isn't working. And I'm taking collective responsibility for this. And one of those things is that we are habituated to looking at NVC through an individual lens and through a lens of conflict resolution and healing and personal growth, rather than looking at it through the lens of what does it have to contribute to efforts to create a different world beyond the individual level, at the systemic level, community level, group level, social action level. And sadly, there are very few of us within the NVC community who focus in these ways. And the result is this asymmetrical thing. For me, NVC is a vital, vital, vital tool for social change for any number of reasons, not the least of which is that deep study of NVC is a kind of insurance policy that you're not going to use the master's tools. But it has to be really deep study and not formula study. So what I mean by deep study is, at the very least, beyond practicing how to make things observational, asking why are we focusing on observation rather than on evaluation? What is the meaning of it? What does it support us in being able to do when we are able to do that? And go on from there with everything that we learn about NVC. Move it from the how and the what to the why. And if we go to the level of why, we will find new questions, which will take us to new study, which will take us into deeper and deeper appreciation of the roots of NVC within nonviolence. I will just leave it here. Okay. Very cool. Thank you. And you're still within this thread?
Yes, I am actually. And it all ties together, especially with what you just said, that I'm thinking we were just in the webinar before us was about creating systems for restorative justice and how important it was to create the systems. What's just come up from what's been discussed is how important it is in the setting of leadership, whether in social change movements or other movements, to create these systems that you're describing, to proactively create the system for support, for mourning, for just changing the model of leadership. And that even in every offering of NVC, that at the beginning, the proactive way to offer it is to emphasize the bigger goal of NVC. If we really take that on as NVC sharers, that is the really bigger goal in the setting of all these other supportive methods, then we're supporting ourselves and others to be supported.
Yeah, if you start NVC training from the question, how do we effectively move from patriarchal functioning to collaborative functioning? If you start with that question, everything that you do from there on is going to be different, even if you use the same specific methods and principles. Thank you. All right. So Tanya, I will just loop back to you. Are you complete? Last thought that you want to share?
I'm very complete and very inspired. Thank you.
I'm so glad. Okay. You're on.
When you mentioned the world, especially the United States and country being in trauma from Trump and Republicans, what came to my mind, Mickey, was the idea that how can I think about Hitler and what he did and the terrors and the horrors and have any type of compassion or understanding for him. And there is a way by, again, getting to the unmet needs of this guy. When he was a baby, you know, he wasn't this way. And all of us are in the same boat to some extent. So I look at myself and have the same initial trigger and reaction with Trump and a lot of the Republicans, that it's a shame that he has co-opted the fear and worries of the past 8 years of recession and got elected and used probably Putin to get the goods on Clinton, et cetera, et cetera.
So I want to ask you to pause and focus and tell me what you want me to engage with, because hearing like a whole political analysis, I'm not sure how it serves our purpose here today.
All right.
I want to hear you and respond to you. So can you focus on what precisely?
Yes. What I want to say is what I have found supportive in NVC is using NVC. And when I get triggered about hearing about you saying about Trump and getting angry, one of the things I have learned or trying to do, and I do this with my wife when I get angry with her, is to be aware in my body that I'm getting angry. And then I try and empathize with myself to say, well, yeah, you should be angry.
I'm really sorry. I'm still not getting what you would like from me. You're speaking, I'm imagining you want to engage with me.
I'm responding to what you said initially. And if it's not helpful, I'm glad to stop.
I'm not asking you to stop. I'm asking you to connect with me.
Okay. You want me to be clearer somehow about what I
want
to
say? I want you to reach for me. And it, interesting, you spoke in the third person about me. So I don't have a sense that you're actually talking to me. My body is experiencing it more as if you are lecturing rather than relating.
Well, some of it is, I think, maybe a need to tell others what I've gained about how to resolve my own triggering of events with what you said regarding Trump.
Okay, so I don't have a sense that what people signed up for is to hear from Chuck about how he resolves triggers at the length that it's taking. I don't think so. I don't know, but I don't think so.
Okay. So, well, I'll stop talking, let somebody else talk, and maybe I'll come back in. I'm going to give myself some self-empathy. And
I'm really thinking that you're hearing me differently from my intention. I'm reaching to connect with you and your heart and what you want in relation to me. And I'm not hearing you speak to me, and I would like you to, because I want to connect with you.
Yes, I think you do, and you want to connect with everyone you talk to, I think.
Yes.
So I appreciate that.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. I wouldn't have been here if I didn't want to interact with you either.
Thank you. And so do it. In this whole thing about the trigger, what would you like from me? Do you want me to just sit and listen along with everyone else? Is that what you would like?
Well,
I doubt it.
I guess maybe I do. That I think a one way you ask the question, how do we deal with such a big problem as Trump and the breakup of these problems in the world caused primarily by this political action?
Okay, so now I think I might be able to connect the thread, and tell me if I get it. That what you would like to do is share with people your way of engaging with it, which is to work out the triggers within you so that you can come to a more compassionate place.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Great.
And secondly, once I can do it within myself, there is a way that I can join with other people in a larger group who can do the same thing to build a group of people who have the same understanding that can morph to something like Martin Luther King's or Gandhi's effect in a much more massive and global resistance against some immoral issue.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. So right now there are no more hands. That will be really sad because we still have about 20, 25 minutes that I can engage with more people about supporting you in where you are struggling to know how to respond.
Hi, Mickey. I am resonating with everything that you're saying. I've seen the changes in my own life moving from a micro focus to a macro focus and thinking about larger frames. What I find troubling within myself is shame around my emotions arising. I was part of a session a couple weeks ago, and in talking about the topic, I was so moved, I started crying in front of the group. So then, you know, there was embarrassment, there was shame. I started to think, oh, people are judging me, that I'm not this or that. And I realized where that comes from. So many years of living within oppressive systems in which emotions were not allowed, starting in my own family and my father's words saying, shut up or I'll give you something else to cry about. Not to be too personal here, but it is for me a difficulty in trying to hold the value of mourning and grief. And at the same time, when it comes out unexpected, as it did, there's this horror, like, oh my God. And I'm looking out and I'm seeing all these faces, which look like me. And a lot of them NVC certified trainers, which was the next layer, to how do I, as a person of color, and I see myself as very, very sensitive, and how do I navigate? Because yep. I do want to be a person who yes. can step into leadership and help to affect change. My emotionality gets in the way of that. So thanks for listening.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say that your father is personal and also not. The role of the family within a patriarchal society is to be the primary site where patriarchy is transferred. Because it has to start early. If it doesn't start early, it's going to be much harder for it to get installed. And so in the family, we get the training, the traumatic training through coercion and shaming, the two primary tools of parenting. So there's nothing specifically personal, although it's 100% personal, if that makes any sense. How that would not be a contradiction. Does it?
I'm not sure, since this is a bit of new information for me.
Okay, let me try to explain it.
Okay.
The impact is 100% personal. The source is systemic.
Is he passing on what was done to him?
It's part of what was done to him, and also the context within which he lived. He also is a product of patriarchy, just like yeah. you. He wasn't born to oppress you. He was born to be a loving, life-affirming, laughing, giggling, exuberant infant like everyone else. That's what he was born to be. And his place within patriarchy is different from your place, is different from my place, is different from anyone else's place. His place is at the nexus of being a man and being a black man within a context of, I don't know where it is, but we can get more specific. If it was in the South, it would be different from if it was in the North. All of these things shape who he is in a systemic way that is always mediated by something specific and personal. So it's very easy to think that it's all individual. When you go looking for a job and you're discriminated against, it's a discrimination against you personally, and it is not. It is a discrimination done by a personal human being, a particular person, and it is not. This is one of the hardest things for us to understand if we're going to create change. The way that things are at one and the same time, both personal and not. Is it making sense now?
Yes, it is.
So, like all children under patriarchy, you were shamed for your feelings. But being a Black elder woman makes the result different from being a white male. The white male also shouldn't display emotions, but the reasons for not displaying emotions and the consequences for displaying emotions are different depending on where you're placed. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it also is a different struggle to come back into your power depending on where you are. To use words that you, I'm sure, know, to oppose racism, if you're Black, you will be uppity. If you're white, you will be a race traitor. Within the normative culture, both of them are held as negative traits, but they carry different consequences depending on where you are. You're more likely to be killed for being uppity than for being a race traitor. These things are not simple or small, and they live in your body. And so this goes back to this kind of like almost mathematical equation. The larger the gap between where you are and full freedom, the more support you will need to be able to walk towards freedom. And one of the really tricky things that people don't think about usually is that for a white male in power, walking towards freedom is damn near impossible. They have a lot of external material freedom to speak, to get good jobs, to be listened to when they speak, all of these things, but none of these things amount to actual inner freedom. I submit that you specifically are freer than many, many, many white males that I meet regularly. I want you to take that in. You have far less external freedom, but much more internal freedom. Can you imagine that being possible?
I'm hearing the words, and it seems like, how could that possibly be true? Because there's the questioner in me.
Because you have access to yourself. You can choose consciously to live in line with your values. It's a struggle. You get afraid, you get shut down, but you keep going. You have pulled yourself up from wherever you were put down enough to know that you're committed to nonviolence, and enough to know what that means, enough to know how huge the gap is for you to get there fully. All this is inner freedom. Even if you get embarrassed and ashamed, the white male wouldn't even let themselves, usually, wouldn't even let themselves cry in public. It just isn't even available to them physiologically anymore. And that doesn't negate the huge amount of external power and access to resources that white males in this world do have. It's just that one doesn't translate into the other. I am delighting in getting you stunned. And I'm also delighting in knowing that when you get stunned, like this, you work with it and you integrate it. That's what I mean. You don't run away. You have enough freedom inside to engage. You know I'm right.
Thank you.
All right, so we got four hands. I'm going to prioritize people I haven't ever talked with, at least not to my memory.
I notice I feel very nervous in sharing about this because there's a really strong inner jackal around stepping up in leadership. Okay. So I have a big judgment that I hold against myself, which is that I don't know enough, or I'm not able enough or clever enough, and how dare I think that I have the place to do so. And so I feel able to get in to make change and to be a leader at the personal level and in the classroom with the children at school and even with other adults when it's at a personal level and in a group level. But when it comes to the idea of me even making systemic changes, I'm like, where do I even start? What do I do? Where do I go? Who do I go to? And if I go to someone and say, I'd like to make changes at this level, they're going to look at me and say, you don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So this is my judgment or my belief.
So two things I want to say. First is a bit of a flippant thing that I enjoy, which is I finally, after many years, came up with an answer to the question, who are you to dot, dot, dot? The answer is, I'm the one who's willing. It's flippant, but it also has a depth to it. And what that means is I am willing to even make mistakes. I'm willing to take action and suffer consequences. I'm willing to come out wrong. I'm willing to be replaced if someone better comes along. But for as long as I don't see anyone stepping into the task that seems so evident in front of us, I will. And that you can do, first of all. Second, the not enough is one of the core ways in which patriarchal training gets us to remain small. I have one more course to take, one more person to speak to, one more degree to get, one more workshop to attend, you know, one more time to be an apprentice, whatever it is. And I want to ask you to trace back, where did that message come from?
I know very well where it came from. And it's a core belief that I have about myself that I've been working with for a long time. And it comes back to a moment in childhood where I got my results from school. I'm dyslexic, and my teachers were saying that I had been daydreaming, and my mom was just like, you're not trying hard enough, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I really, really took this as the truth, that it's my fault and I'm obviously stupid.
So you're working with it, doing healing work, et cetera. I want to put in a tiny plug for my sister's course called The Compass, which is a new method for healing that she developed based on NVC and a number of other ways that I think is absolutely genius. And I highly recommend that you take it if you can. It's online. But aside from that, one of the things that we are called to do in this time, in my opinion, is to reject the messages that we received and take action anyway. Because every time you believe your core belief to the point of inaction, you are supporting the status quo. A couple of weeks ago, at a retreat that I co-led, there was an evening program that was led by one of the participants, in which we did an activity of dividing into half, and one half of us were people from seven generations hence, coming back to interview the people of this time. It was a very deeply moving activity. And one of the things that I got from it, because I was in the, you know, perspective mindset of someone in the future, knowing that somehow we managed to survive these times, that was the premise. because it's not clear that we will. But in order to believe that we could survive, I saw that we have to believe that no action is too small as a starting place. It doesn't mean that it will actually create the change, but since we don't know what will, we cannot not do something just because it's small.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm not longing for this question to be answered now, but I notice my question is, I feel like I've made the smaller actions and I'm looking for the courage to make the bigger ones that seem very scary.
And then the next thing is, don't do it alone. That's where support comes in. You know, the big mythology that I had for decades about Gandhi was completely shattered one day when I realized that for like 15 years, he had this ashram of 70 people that were living together, strategizing together, cleaning together, eating together, a real community before he went on the salt march. He was not alone. So take that.
I definitely will.
Okay, thank you. And
I just returned literally half an hour ago from teaching a 3-hour workshop to homeowner association board members. So the city wanted communication skills taught because these homeowner associations have so much conflict, so many conflicts. And I got in there and I was teaching them about self-connection with it and having them play empathy poker and then starting to do some role plays. And what I found was there are a lot of people who just didn't want to go there. They don't want to take the time. It takes too much time. Just send them a letter. Tell them this. Basically, these people are trying to figure out how to get people to obey the rules of the homeowners association. Don't put swings up. Don't put fences up. Don't have dogs. And all they want to know is, how do I get people to stop doing that stuff? So my question for you is, should I just not even be entering a situation like that? Should I just be going to people who really want to learn about connecting communication?
I would say yes and yes and yes and yes and yes. What I mean is, first of all, you need to know your strength. If you are strong in bridge building, go talk to whoever wants to hear from you. If you're not strong in bridge building, like first person singular here isn't, don't do it. I don't know your actual strength in this area. Second, there is a tendency within the NVC community implicitly to expect other people to leave their worldview and their zone of comfort and come to ours. So even when we try to do bridge building, we do it by inviting people, not by walking towards them. What you can do instead is, when you have been, ask them, when you've been successful at getting people to stop, what worked? When you haven't been successful, do you have any sense of what didn't work? Get it from them instead of feeding them an answer that is just hanging there unrelated to their experience. You see what I mean?
Yes, I think so. Although I will say that I was making every example specific to a homeowners association board member and a resident.
Yeah, but it's an example that you came up with. That you...
No, employed. I mean that what they were bringing, like those three things,
okay,
that I just meant.
But still, they brought the example and you gave them the answer. Until they see that what they are doing is not working, they will not be open to something else.
They seem to be pretty convinced that they needed to get people to do, they needed to get, and what, it's really,
that's
really clear.
Fine. If that's what they think they need to learn that their methods for getting people to do it are not working. You're trying to change them at an ideological level instead of meeting them at their turf and showing them that practically what they're doing is not going to work for them. We cannot change people ideologically unless they want to be. I think that is the end in terms of, I want to pass it to Lori. And of course, we could continue for another very long time. But in honor of this day, I'm going to pause here. Thank you for bringing it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Bye for now.